Hello and welcome to the People Who Read People podcast. This is a podcast about better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. On this show, I talk to a variety of people from a variety of professions about their understanding of human behavior and psychology. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. Today's episode is about psychopaths and psychopathic traits. I talked to Dr. Nadja Heim, that's H-E-Y-M, who is an associate professor in personality psychology and psychopathology at Nottingham Trent University in the UK. The reason I wanted to cover this topic was to examine some nuance in the area of psychopathy, and to get a chance to ask some questions I've just been curious about in this area, which is one of the reasons I like doing this podcast, getting to ask my ignorant questions of people who know a lot more than me. To take one example of something I've been curious about, I often see people throwing around the label psychopath in ways that seem simplistic and unhelpful. Clearly, as with a lot of psychological labels, the general public and entertainment media often misuse these terms. For example, we can see people calling random people psychopaths all the time, whether it's a politician they don't like or a CEO that's done some bad stuff. It's similar with how people throw around the word narcissist so much these days. But I also see people using these labels for themselves in ways that seem to me simplistic and a bit unhealthy. To take a specific example, I've seen people take online tests that are meant to tell you if you have psychopathic traits, and then they use the results of these tests, which are often pretty simplistic, as evidence to say things like, "Yeah, I'm a bit of a psychopath." And some people even seem to take a bit of joy and pride in that, which I think reflects our cultural love affair with villains and antiheroes. And I'm interested in how the self-labeling can be self-restricting in various ways. If someone thinks, "Hey, I'm a psychopath, that's just the way things are," or if they even take a little pride in it, they're not going to be very incentivized to change. And that also gets into questions I have about how much of these so-called psychopathic traits are simply aspects of immaturity, in the sense that sometimes when we're young, we have a hard time caring about other people. Or how many of these traits might be just due to people disliking other people and having some antisocial tendencies that they can then interpret as something that they can't help, as something intrinsic and unchangeable about them. And then, even apart from the loose ways that us regular people can use these terms, which isn't surprising, even some pretty knowledgeable people and experts seem to use these terms in some seemingly cavalier and loose ways. I recently read John Ronson's book, The Psychopath Test, and in there he describes Robert Hare, who was well known for developing the mainstream definition of what a psychopath is, talking very cavalierly about people around him who might be potential psychopaths. In one scene, Bob Hare tells the author that a hotel employee who acts a little rudely might be a psychopath. As Hare tells the author, "A lot of psychopaths become gatekeepers, concierges, security guards, masters of their own domain." They talk about this for a while, and Ronson finds this interesting, but then later thinks to himself, "Was that a bit trigger-happy? Maybe the guy just had a long, bad day. Why did neither Bob nor I think of that?" To take another example, there's a neuroscientist named James Fallon who's gotten a lot of attention in the last few years for his book, The Psychopath Inside. He claims he has a, quote, psychopathic brain based on how his brain scan shows similarities to the brains of psychopathic killers that he studied. But is it proven that one can look at a brain scan and say that someone is a psychopath? I've personally seen no good evidence presented for that, even if there seems to be some evidence that there's a correlation there. Is it perhaps a bit over the top and grandiose to say that your brain is psychopathic? And some of the things he describes about his own life as ways to show that he has some psychopathic traits simply didn't sound that psychopathic to me, and sounded more like some random dumb things that people sometimes do that can be a bit dangerous and irresponsible. Which I think gets back to some of my general skepticism about these terms. And to be completely clear, I'm not skeptical that there are people who have a constellation of traits that we can label psychopathic. Like any psychological term, these things can be useful labels for various groupings of traits. But I do tend to get a bit skeptical when people seem to throw around these terms loosely and cavalierly. And maybe I'm a bit off base with my skepticism. I'm admittedly not an expert. But I am curious about these things and thought it would be interesting to throw some of these questions I have at an expert. I learned about Nadja Heim's work when I read a piece on Vice.com by her titled, "There's a Little Bit of Psychopath in All of Us." In that piece, she examined some of the nuance in that area and corrected some misunderstandings. a little bit more about Nadja from her university page. Dr. Heim's main research interests are in the area of individual differences, psychopathology, and antisocial behavior. She's an expert in dark personality traits, for example, psychopathy, narcissism, Machiavellianism, and sadism. Her research aims to further our understanding of the neuropsychological mechanisms, such as punishment and reward sensitivity, goal conflict processing, and behavioral inhibition deficits underpinning psychopathology and antisocial tendencies. She has published peer-reviewed papers on threat processing, impulsivity and anxiety in psychopathology, such as antisocial personality disorder, psychopathy, ADHD, depression, and self-harm. Her research also focuses on the specific roles of affective and cognitive empathy deficits in the associations between maladaptive traits, as well as different types of aggressive behavior. End quote. An interesting research paper by her and her colleagues is from 2021 and is called The Dark Empath, Characterizing Dark Traits in the Presence of Empathy. To quote from some sections of that paper, a well-established literature associates these dark traits with empathy deficits, that is, an impairment in the ability to take the perspective of others, understand their viewpoints, and share their emotions to attain interpersonal reciprocity. To this end, the current study investigates the existence of darkness in the presence of empathy, a combination we refer to as the dark empath. End quote. If you're hearing this, you're listening to the free version of this podcast. If you've enjoyed this podcast and what I'm trying to do with it, would you be willing to show your support by signing up for a paid premium subscription? It's only $5 per month, and you get a few benefits, like ad-free episodes and details about upcoming interviews I'm doing, and the chance to collaborate on episodes and submit questions to ask. But most importantly, you'd be helping me make the podcast better, encouraging me to spend more time on it, and helping me promote it. To learn more about benefits of the premium membership, go to my website, behavior-podcast.com. Okay, here's the talk with Nadja Heim about those pesky psychopaths. Hi, Nadja. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Zach. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here with you today.
Thanks. Maybe a good place to start would be, how do you define psychopathy and how do you differentiate between psychopathic traits and then, you know, using the label psychopath? I know that's probably a big question, but maybe you could give your thoughts on how you define those things.
Yeah, it's quite a massive question, in fact. One of the main issues we have here is that, there isn't just one conceptualization of what psychopathy is. So there are various different models. But in general, there's some commonality, at least. So when we talk about psychopathy, we probably mean, or direct more likely, the construct of personality disorder. And when I talk about psychopathic traits, I talk about personality traits that are related to what we see in psychopathy. Mm-hmm. So from a dimensional point of view of personality, we assume that people can, you know, score from very low to very high on specific personality traits. And there are certain traits that are related to psychopathy itself that are similar enough to what we see in psychopathy. But it's a combination of traits that are coming together that we might then see as being particularly maladaptive or particularly similar to what we see in full-blown psychopathy, let's say. Mm. Coming back to psychopathy and what psychopathy is, one of the most prominent models, I think, in clinical psychopathy would be that of Robert Hare. He defines two main factors here, and one is the affective interpersonal factor, and one is the lifestyle antisocial factor. And when we're looking at the affective interpersonal aspects, we distinguish in terms of the affect that might be quite poor positive and negative affect. It's defined by callousness, lack of remorse and empathy. So one of the big hallmarks in psychopathy is this lack of empathy. In terms of their interpersonal features, we're seeing an individual who's quite superficially charming and therefore can be quite adjusted in terms of personal interaction. However, the individual is quite deceitful, conning, and manipulative, and quite strategic in their way in terms of achieving their goals and what they want. They can be egocentric and selfish and engage in pathological lying. When we're looking at the other side, the kind of antisocial behavior type factors, there's a lifestyle aspect. So it's an individual quite impulsive and reckless and irresponsible in their behavior. They might lack long-term goals. They have a high need for stimulation, so high sensation-seeking, risk-taking behaviors. And then we have the fourth aspect there, the antisocial behavior itself. So that's, of course, the poor behavioral control that leads to kind of persistent rule breaking and criminal behavior. So often psychopathy, of course, is studied in the context of forensic psychology, therefore, in terms of criminal psychopathy.
So the with the charming aspect, I see that, you know, a lot, in a lot of people's concepts or definitions of, you know, what makes a so-called psychopath, a lot of people point to that charming aspect. I'm curious, did that come in later? You know, it seems like the definition of psychopath might have drifted a bit over time. And I'm curious, did the kind of like superficially charming aspect maybe come in later? Like, was that part of like Hare's definition? And how do you see that? Do you see it as being a necessary part of a psychopathic trait compilation?
Well, actually, the charming aspect came from the seminal work from Cleckley and The Mask of Sanity, a book that was written in the 1970s. And this was an early clinical description of cases that Cleckley had encountered in his work. And he described 16 different criteria there of the prototypical psychopath. And the charming aspect, superficially charming aspect, was part of that. So that was part of what he called the positive adjustment, where we have superficial charm, social adaptness, absence of nervousness and delusion. So individuals who seem to be on the surface, you know, are quite well adjusted.
And one of the reasons I wanted to do this talk was I see so many seemingly simplistic uses of the word psychopath these days, which is probably just a general, you know, misuse in the culture of how we use psychological terms in general, like calling so many people, you know, narcissists and psychopaths and things like this. And, you know, the reason I reached out to you was I saw your Vice article about, you know, psychopathy being a spectrum, and we're all somewhere on that spectrum. And I'm curious, do you agree, you know, that we seem to be misusing a lot of these labels, not just for what we call other people, but I've even seen people take these online tests that seem very simplistic to me about, you know, whether it's about narcissism or psychopathy. And then I even know people that will like kind of self-label themselves psychopaths. And it just feels like there's this simplistic usage, which not only results in kind of mislabeling, you know, miscategorizing people we don't know well, but also even miscategorizing ourselves, which can lead to, you know, kind of a lack of willingness to change, or just being like, well, I guess I have psychopathic traits. And I'm curious, do you see some of that in the culture?
Yeah, absolutely. especially the term of narcissist is really, you know, free floating around at the moment everywhere, isn't it? Wherever you look, you seem to be stumbling across it. And it's a little bit of a problem because, you know, it's again that whole notion that we might want to differentiate between a personality disorder and traits. Right. And traits, narcissistic traits can be seen, and, you know, elevated narcissistic traits can be seen in many people, just as we can see psychopathic traits elevated in you know, everyday people. But it doesn't make them a fully kind of clinically diagnosed psychopath or someone with narcissistic personality disorder. The other issue is also that what we might need to think about is that psychopathy itself wasn't necessarily part of the diagnostic statistical kind of manual for a long time. It's only just been recently really firmly integrated in the fifth version of the DSM. And so the term psychopath nevertheless existed in the research literature for a long time. And in terms of diagnosis, you know, one of the most kind of the gold standard diagnostic tool is, again, Hare's psychopathy checklist. And in order to be diagnosed, you really got to hit a lot of points there. You really need to, you know, there are 20 items across which, you know, you need to score quite highly to be diagnosed as a psychopath. And the psychopath itself is a very dangerous individual. Yet we can, for each of these points, we can look at some traits that might be related to these behaviors. So, you know, one of the points would be the glibness and the superficial charm again. you know. And of course, there are many people who are very charming, but that doesn't make them a psychopath. It's the accumulation of different aspects coming together that might make a toxic mix, or problematic mix that leads to more maladaptive forms and more kind of, you know, disordered behavior in the end. Mm-hmm.
It seems like in psychology in general, there's a move away from using, you know, these nouns for people like psychopath or narcissist, because they can be, you know, the stigma attached or the, you know, self-limiting nature of the labels. And do you see that, you know, are people in general more careful with how they use that? And do they tend to try to talk more about like psychopathic trait compilations and not use the word psychopath these days?
Certainly when we study it in the general population, yes, I would say so. And it's really important to differentiate there. I mean, when it comes, you know, our diagnostic our manuals and tools are important in the clinical fields and in the forensic fields, and assessing someone thoroughly to establish if they have a disorder can be quite important, right? So in some cases, you need to have a diagnosis in order to receive the right support options, for example, or in order to identify risk and specific needs, depending on what your problem areas are, for example. And we know that, you know, individuals who are formally properly diagnosed with psychopathy, you know, this diagnostic tool has a really high predictive power in terms of risk assessment and recidivism, reoffending. These individuals commit more crimes, a larger variety, more violent, more premeditated and instrumental. They're four times more likely to commit future crimes, etc. So being able to diagnose using diagnostic tools in specifically problematic populations, so dangerous populations, for example, is important, you know, and so we can't wipe that away. However, when we study psychopathy or psychopathic traits in the general population, I personally think the usage of psychopathic traits is more appropriate rather than the full-blown term there. Mm-hmm.
We sometimes hear about the bad seed explanation of psychopathy or other personality traits, that sometimes psychopaths just come out of nowhere due to their genes. There's something in their brains that make those traits inevitable. And I'm curious, I know this isn't your specialty, but do you have thoughts you'd like to share on the bad seed explanations of psychopathy and how much of those kind of dark personality trait compilations are due to genetic versus upbringing factors?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of research around the genetic underpinnings and brain abnormalities, let's say, linked to psychopathy. And, you know, it's not weak evidence. So there's certainly plenty of evidence around there showing that there might be some genetic predispositions and that there might be brain differences in psychopathy. Mm-hmm. But generally, with all personality traits, we assume some kind of heritability. We assume some kind of brain or biological markers that underpin our personality traits. And in the same way, we would assume that for personality disorders, they're at the extreme end of personality traits, because we're taking this dimensional approach where we say right at the extreme ends of certain traits, we see problematic behaviors maybe. And it's not really a matter of, oh, there's one gene, and if you've got that gene, then that's it, right? So the explanations are more around a combination of genes, maybe neurotransmitters, combination of brain abnormalities and brain function that might combine into that one profile or that one kind of construct that we see at the other end.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I often wonder about these dark personality traits, I'm a big believer in the impact of the environment and even less obvious impacts. You know, for example, we tend to think of abuse as the more obvious forms of abuse, like the physical, the sexual, the extreme psychological. But personally, I think that there's this whole realm of less obvious psychological or abuse or neglect that's, whether it's purposeful or not, that parents with various kind of personality defects, like, you know, pathological narcissism, these things that don't rise to, you know, being obvious forms of abuse, but that can mess up their children in various ways. And I think there's kind of a hidden epidemic of that kind of thing that, you know, is not like it's purposeful. It's just ways that kids can get messed up by the psychological problems of their parents. And that can be hard to see and also just hard to talk about because, you know, we don't want to imply that that is a, you know, a malicious thing the parents are necessarily doing. But I'm curious if you'd agree that, do you think that could be the some of the cause of some of these antisocial personality traits that get, you know, lumped into the psychopathic barrel, even if those, you know, like you were talking about, can have some genetic predispositions. But I'm curious if you see the environment there as having some a big amount of influence in ways that aren't even obvious.
Absolutely. There's, you know, no two ways about it in terms of, you know, antisocial behavior itself, never mind whether with or without psychopathy. Antisocial behavior has quite a strong kind of environmental impact there, or predictors there. So it can be a combination. So you might have some genetic predispositions, and then the environment in which you grow up might then really shape the expression of these predispositions and whether they come to show some kind of full-blown problematic behavior. So, for example, in terms of psychopathy, when we study these traits in children, we talk about colors and emotional traits.
A note here. I myself wasn't sure what Nadja was saying here, so I thought I'd clarify. She was saying callous and unemotional traits, also known as CU traits for short. This is a label for traits that's often used in research of antisocial behavior. Back to the talk.
And so there's a lot of research that has been conducted in children that engage in impulsive behavior and conduct problems. And these that can then be kind of split in those who have colors and emotional traits and those who haven't got the colors and emotional traits. And we know that children with colors and emotional traits tend to have a much earlier onset of antisocial behavior and aggressive behavior and more severe indicators of aggressive behavior. It tends to be much more stable over time and is less treatment responsive compared to those kids without those CU traits. And there have been some studies looking at the kind of genetic heritability underpinnings and environmental factors. There was a review by S.E. Widding, for example, some years ago in terms of looking at twin studies there. And CU traits alone predicted about 67% of the heritability, whereas antisocial behavior with CU traits together predicted about 81% heritability. And when we're looking at just antisocial behavior without CU traits, there's a 30% heritability. And just from the research on aggressive and antisocial behavior itself, we know that environmental factors like low SES and poor peer relationships, for example, so friendships that engage in criminal behavior, can account for about 30% of antisocial behavior. Mm-hmm. So they are quite predictive. And this is where the combination of things is coming together, right? So if you have a genetic predisposition, for example, and you have the adverse environmental kind of predictors coming together, then the risk is much higher than either one alone.
You know the movie, or based on the play, The Bad Seed? Have you seen that? Just a correction here. The Bad Seed was first actually a book, then a Broadway play, then became a movie. Back to the talk.
No, I'm afraid not. Oh, okay. I shall put it on my movie.
Yeah, it's an old movie. Okay. I think they made several remakes of it, but right, the original movie was from the 1950s or maybe 60s black and white movie. Okay. But it's interesting because I think it kind of informs the cultural idea of psychopathy, where it's like basically it's about this young girl who just is a cold blooded murderer, like right out of the gate, you know. but I think it's an interesting cultural thing, because I think that's a lot of people's idea of like, oh, you're just born this cold-blooded murderer, right? Which I think, you know, as we've been talking about, it's a lot more complex than that. Even if someone believes it's largely or a big genetic component, yeah. But yeah, recommend that movie. It's interesting, even just for the cultural aspects.
Yes, I shall have a look. And actually, there are so many movies out there. Silence of the Lambs was another one, a classic kind of portrayal there, wasn't it? And you know, they are probably based on some of the kind of seminal work back in the day. But we also need to remember, I mean, when these movies were made and what we knew at the time and what we know now might be different. And so these, all of this kind of, you know, the evidence base might feed somewhat into it. But then in the end, with movies or mainstream media, you know, it's meant to be enticing for the viewer, and it doesn't always have to be, you know, based on facts and truth, I guess.
Regarding the, you know, my, basically, I'm just giving my various forms of skepticism about various things, but I guess I'll continue. So one thing I've been a bit skeptical of is, you've probably heard of James Fallon, who's a doctor who's gotten a good amount of press and attention over the last few years for saying that he has a, quote, psychopathic brain. And the story goes, for people who don't know, that he noticed similarities between the brain scans of cold-blooded killers, psychopathic trait killers that he was studying, and similarities with his own brain scans, which had something to do with the lack of activity in the lower cortex, I think, basically. One exact quote from him is, "I found I had the brain imaging pattern and genetic makeup of a full-blown psychopath." And I'm admittedly an amateur on these things, but the reason I was skeptical of some of this is that I haven't seen any specific proof that you can definitely say, if you have this type of brain scan, you are high in psychopathic traits. I get that there can be correlations there, you know, but to say that I have a psychopathic brain just seems like a very certain way to phrase, and I just haven't seen, you know, that kind of evidence that, you know, for example, like, can you have that type of brain scan and be high in empathetic traits? Like, I haven't seen, you know, much about that. And I'm curious, I know that this, the neuroscience aspect isn't your specialty, but I'm curious if you think it's okay to, or justified for me to be a bit skeptical of that certainty there.
No, absolutely, it's justified. I think I'm assuming he himself is skeptical about it, as possibly as well. You know, you might see some genetic makeup that might be similar, or that might be common across individuals. But as we just said, you know, the nature nurture issue, the interaction between factors and combination of factors that are coming together is important. And I think, you know, in some of the podcasts that James Fallon did, he was talking about, you know, he had a really good upbringing, he had a healthy family relationships, and, you know, he had very nurturing environment as he grew up, and that was probably a good protective factor for him, even if he had some genetic predispositions or some, you know, brain imaging kind of patterns that might be similar to what we see in psychopathy. But clearly in his case, his social and interpersonal functioning has been preserved, presumably. I'm not sure whether he ever did a full diagnostic test, but I'm pretty sure he, you know, wouldn't quite qualify as a fully diagnosed criminal psychopath. So yeah, he had those protective aspects. And that's coming back to you. I mean, you were talking about adverse childhood experiences and childhood abuse. And there's, you know, evidence out there showing that individuals with psychopathy were more likely to have some kind of traumatic experiences. But all of this, again, goes also back to our conceptualizations of psychopathy and the different types that are out there, because we are not necessarily always assuming that the psychopathy is a homogenous kind of construct. But some people differentiate between the primary and the secondary psychopath, for example, are slightly different. And socioeconomic status, trauma, adverse childhood experiences, etc., seem to be more prominent in what we call the secondary psychopath, which is probably a bit more similar to what we have in antisocial personality disorder. So we're seeing someone who's highly impulsive and has difficulties in terms of their behavioral control, for example. And that might not be the case for him, as he seems to be behaviorally really, you know, probably well adjusted. And he might show some of the emotional detachment aspects, maybe some of the affective or interpersonal aspects, but he might not see the problems that we have in the lifestyle and antisocial factors in terms of that reckless style, that constant need for stimulation or poor behavioral control that then is more likely to lead to antisocial behavior.
Yeah. And to be a little bit more specific, I guess I'm just, it's strange to me for, I just haven't seen, and it may just be because I'm ignorant of the area, but I just haven't seen a proof saying, like, if you have this kind of brain scan, like you will, you know, you definitely have a what we could call a psychopathic brain, even if you've gotten good things to balance out of it. It's almost like, to me, the more accurate way to phrase it would be, I have a brain that has traits that is more likely to be correlated with, you know, these antisocial or psychopathic traits. In other words, like, I haven't seen a proof that like one can't have that brain scan and then we find that they actually have a lot of high empathy traits, you know. But I think it's the difference between like the correlation and like boldly stating that I have a psychopathic brain that seems a little bit overly certain to me. But it might just, you know, maybe I'm just ignorant of the amount of proof that's gone into that or something.
It probably is. And I think the issue is, you know, if you try to explain it properly, it takes a lot more words. Right. You know, as we've just seen, right, when you're trying to put it into the correlational kind of explanation, it really requires much more explanation because of the complexity of the issue, right? And so sometimes to make just that kind of heading news, you know, people might use a shortcut to grab attention, and hopefully they will then use the space and the attention they get to clarify exactly what they mean. And so, of course, when we write papers, academic papers, for example, you know, we think very carefully how we state things. When things are being translated into media, it often pops out slightly differently. And yeah, to make it more understandable for people, for example, in terms of using lay language rather than academic language, or to make it, you know, shorter, briefer, rather than giving a long spiel of explaining the exact complexities that might be involved. And sometimes that might come through. So, I mean, you were talking about earlier in terms of the conversation piece where I referred to a spectrum in that piece. And that was actually, I would have preferred the term dimensional, right? Dimensional construct rather than spectrum, because even spectrum, the terminology, is not particularly the ideal case to use here.
Right.
But it was used because of trying to put it in lay language that people may be more likely to understand and incorporate in their everyday usage of language.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even the spectrum lends more nuance, but it's still a simplistic idea of so many of these things, because, as you say, yeah, it's a multi-dimensional matrix of some sort that we don't really understand, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a very difficult combination of many traits coming together. It's not just one trait, it's many traits coming together and in a multidimensional space. And this is where the complexity lies. And actually, because psychopathy is not a homogeneous construct, it might be a different combination of traits coming together that are not always exactly the same, right? So we've been talking about the hallmark of the lack of empathy. And then more recently, we have seen in our Dark Empath paper that you referred to earlier is that, you know, there are some individuals who have elevated dark traits, so psychopathic, narcissistic, Machiavellian traits, but they show really high levels of empathy. And actually, probably in terms of everyday interaction in society, they might possibly be a bit more successful, a bit less antisocial, and perform better. So in terms of the analysis we did, we saw that they are more extroverted, for example. We see they are less aggressive than those with dark traits and low levels of empathy, right? So we see, depending on the combination of those dark traits and whether you have high or low empathy, we already see different outcomes there.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the dark empath kind of traits, is that more likely to be tied to some sort of abusive or neglectful childhood where somebody basically enjoys or has a animosity towards other people, you know? So because it seems like that the logical way that could come about is you have some sort of you're normal in the sense that you can have empathy for other people, but maybe you've had some experiences that made you kind of high animosity or kind of enjoy, you know, putting people down or seeing them, you know, suffer a little bit or something. Do you think, is that part of what your research has been about, or do you go into that?
Possibly. I mean, the dark traits, because they have that kind of, well, callousness and that kind of maybe being less caring about others might show that. And then the capacity to empathize might put a slightly different slant on it. So if you completely lack empathy for other people, you might not understand that they're distressed. So you might not have a kind of inhibitory mechanism to tell you that, wait a second, you know, somebody is really sad or frightened or upset. I better just, you know, try to make them feel better, or I try to care about this and stop bullying them, for example. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you are lacking that capacity, it might just make you keep going, because you really don't care about the feelings of the other person necessarily. However, if you have higher levels of empathy, then it seems to be acting as a little bit of an inhibitory mechanism that might allow you to control your behavior better, that you then initiate some pro-social behavior towards the individual who is in distress, for example. Quite a bit of research that has shown that individuals with psychopathy might struggle in terms of recognizing or processing or paying attention towards the distress of other people. So recognizing specifically sadness or fear in others. And that has always been used as an explanation why they are so antagonistic and why they are so aggressive towards others.
Whereas like a dark empath might be somebody that actually can feel the other person's pain and actually can maybe enjoy that in kind of a sadistic sort of way. Is that accurate to say?
Possibly.
Some of them.
I think sadism is in itself, again, slightly different to psychopathy, I guess. But so we don't know the exact mechanisms in terms of sadism. But one assumption would be that sadistic individuals might enjoy the pain. Well, they enjoy the, you know, humiliating others and seeing pain in others. So which makes you think that, you know, they must be able to process that pain in others somewhat. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Do you see, so one thing I see around us is kind of a cultural love affair with psychopaths, in the sense that we have all of these movies and shows where the protagonists are pretty bad, antisocial people. And I personally know people that kind of like proudly proclaim that they're psychopaths. You know, they've taken these tests online and they're like, you know, that's just how I am. And even my family, you know, tells me that, or my wife tells me that, and kind of a proud way. And I am curious what you think. Is there sort of an unhealthy sort of love affair going on with the, you know, the anti-hero, the psychopath kind of personality traits?
I'm sure, you know, I mean, sometimes, you know, people might just want to stay, stand out. Mm-hmm. It might be more of one aspect,
different.
Be different, yeah. You know, and yeah. There's this whole notion about, you know, girls like bad boys type aspects. I mean, maybe because they're associated with more sensation seeking, adrenaline junkies, you know, with more exciting lifestyle, fast paced lifestyle, these kind of things. And that might make them more excitable. I'm not sure. But to be fair, research shows that in terms of long term mating preferences, I think the more stable and safe, secure options are preferred to have family relations with. But, you know, there might be that thing whereby, you know, people want to be cool. And in terms of being cool, you must be a little bit of bad. And
people don't want to give a fuck. They always say, they, you know, I give no fucks kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. But that might also just be a wall, a barrier, an emotional kind of, you know, don't come too close to me. You don't know, you know, what might be the motivation for people in terms of saying that or being
right.
like that. But in some individuals, you truly have that I give no fuck situation. And they're the ones that might be dangerous, because they're the ones that really won't care about hurting you.
Like you say, online, especially when people are always insulting each other online, there's that, you know, people can say things they really don't mean, in the sense that, like, I don't care what anyone thinks about me. And it's really just a protective thing to say. Your words are not going to harm me. But yeah, my joke about that is, you know, who really doesn't give a fuck is psychopaths. They truly don't. Anyway. So I'm curious, do you see a link with autism? Because I was reading some articles about people that were self-proclaimed psychopaths. And one article in the Independent newspaper online was someone admitting that they didn't care about the Holocaust and admitting to kicking their dog. And it made me think, like, this person just sounds like really autistic, like in the sense that they would be even willing to say that publicly. Made me think, you know, and then that got me down a rabbit hole of people, you know, they overlap sometimes of the autistic and psychopathic traits. And I'm curious, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I see them, but yes, I have thoughts, but no, I don't see them as being similar. I see them as very different, in fact. I think in terms of the empathy capacities or deficits, is in autism we see a lack of cognitive empathy. So that's the kind of theory of mind, so the mentalizing thing that other individuals might have a different kind of mental state to your own, and that's somewhat quite different to what is more the problem seen in psychopathy in terms of their affective deficit, as in I can't feel what you're feeling. Right. So one is, I don't understand what you're thinking. And that makes it difficult for me to navigate in the world because I find it difficult to predict your behavior, which we might see in autism. And whereas in psychopathy, it's more a matter of, I don't feel what you feel. I don't understand what you feel. I don't care about what you feel. And therefore it's okay for me to hurt you. So it's a very different, aspect there. And this is, I mean, there's been some very old kind of studies that try to equate the two, but it has been mainly kind of debunked nowadays. And we see really, truly very different patterns of underpinning mechanisms, for example, or different kind of correlates and relationships for autistic traits as opposed to psychopathic traits. So I would, you know, really try and keep these separate as much as possible.
Well, do you think it's possible some people are just misdiagnosing themselves then when somebody reaches out to a journalist and says, I'm a psychopath? And I think we have to be more skeptical of these kinds of things because, for example, there's this book by it's an anonymously published book that's pretty popular. And I can't remember the name now, but it's by a self-proclaimed psychopath. And I read some about this book, and this person's online and has a online following, but they're a very unreliable narrator. Like, some people think they just made up their past, you know, for attentions to sell books. Some people think they're just a narcissist who likes the attention. So I think when I read some of this stuff, especially about the self-proclaimed psychopaths or any self-proclaimed, any kind of category, I guess, I don't know if you would agree that we should be a little bit more skeptical because the self-reporting aspect of these things can be, you know, I think we're a little bit too trusting where we're like, oh, they said they're a psychopath and they're telling us how it is to be a psychopath. And yeah, I think we should be a little bit more skeptical and take things with a little bit more salt, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Unless you have had a full diagnosis using a properly validated psychometric tool to do so. I don't think, you know, you can self-label or should self-label in any case. And the problem is we always see a list of symptoms and we say, oh yeah, that might apply to me. That might apply to me. So I always say that to my students. And when I teach them about psychopathologies, I say, you know, we will go through various different disorders. You will see some symptoms and you might kind of almost tick for yourself those boxes, but please just avoid self-diagnosis. Because it's not okay. You know, we shouldn't be doing that. You know, that there are tools that do that properly. But even, you know, as with any psychometric measure, you know, it gives a probability, let's say, but it's not always 100% accurate either, right? So some are more validated than others. Some have stronger research kind of evidence behind them to be strong psychometric tools than others, etc. So with all of this, we have to be really careful, to be fair. And for any diagnosis, it requires an experienced person who have been highly trained to know what they're doing to diagnose someone properly. And these are experts. These are people who know what they're doing. So any self-diagnosis is always dangerous. And the stigma that one might attach or that with that labeling that comes with it, it can be, you know, dangerous as well. As you said, in terms of self-fulfilling prophecy, in terms of, you know, how we interact with other people, how other people will start interacting with us if we say these things.
Right. Yeah. That it gets into that, that kind of self-limiting aspect where, you know, at certain points in my life, like, you know, flipping through various DSM kind of categories, you know, at certain points in my life, I've thought I was a borderline personality disorder. I thought I was an avoidant personality disorder. You know, I could have really embraced the, you know, super depressed label because I have taken, you know, I was really depressed at one point in time. I've had general anxiety and used to take medications for bad anxiety. But I think it gets to this kind of like hypochondriac, or not even hypochondriac, but just the fact that we all have to some degree these experiences of different sorts. And
absolutely,
when we read these descriptions, there can be this tendency to be like, oh, that I felt that way, you know, where it's like you say, it's much more complex. And you feeling that way at a certain point in time doesn't mean that you always have, you know, consistently have those traits and things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is where more thorough testing comes into play, really, to fully look at things. And also that the time span you're looking at in which people display certain traits, for example, or certain symptoms, depending what you're looking at. And that again, you know, is qualified by the diagnostic tools in terms of, you know, what's the time span looking. Because yeah, of course we might all feel sad when we had sad experiences. You know, it doesn't mean that we are necessarily depressed, and what depression means a lot more than that. It's you know, and it's a combination of many things coming together, that qualify as depression, anxiety, whatever it might be. The same for psychopathy. You know, you might be in some situations a bit callous, you know, because for whatever reason you have to. But it doesn't mean you are a psychopath, you know. And sometimes we might suppress our emotional response towards others because we need to, you know, get something done. And it doesn't mean we are a psychopath necessarily. It's just how things come together and how they influence your everyday behavior over a long period of time that can become quite maladaptive in the way how you function in society and whether you become a risk to yourself or to society.
Do you think, can some psychopathic seeming traits, especially in younger people, just be a sign of a combination of basically immaturity and childlike selfishness and maybe combined with, you know, a rough childhood? And to give a specific example, I was, sometimes I'd watch these interrogations of, you know, killers. And I was watching one about, a kid who killed his dad and two brothers. And it was very, he was a high school kid. And, you know, I think there would be a tendency to say this kid is a psychopath. He probably met all the traits, but then like, the more I learned about the case, like his grandfather, after he had killed his family members, his grandfather said that the dad had been psychologically abusive to him, and he was actually defending the son's, you know, messed up mental state. And it got me thinking, like, you know, some of the things that we can perceive as psychopathic could just be due to like almost like a child, like, you know, we all have that remembrance of being a child and being like, I'm suffering. How can I solve it? I'll think of some simplistic solution that, you know, just makes things worse. And I wonder, you know, how much of these things, and it's not like it was this well executed plan. It was like he immediately got caught for it, and he clearly like was just a really kind of dumb kid in a way. And it got me thinking, you know, is that psychopathy? Can we say for sure? Is it possible that he was just in a really dark place mentally, and that was like the only way his dark suffering place knew to get out of this situation? Things like that. Do you see some of this nuance for some of those, especially for the young kids?
Absolutely. I mean, the problem is that when we're looking at children or adolescents, we shouldn't be really referring to psychopathy in the first place. Like with antisocial personality disorder, psychopathy, et cetera, we're looking at least 18 years of age before we're starting diagnosing, because the assumption is that during childhood, your personality still develops and it manifests into something that there is in adulthood. And this is why a lot of the research tends to refer more to colors and emotional traits in children rather than psychopathy. Okay. So that's the first thing. So even from a kind of ethic reason, I would not like to label children as psychopaths and try to stay away from that. Okay. But yes, we might possibly see colors and emotional traits in some children that might be early indicators for a trajectory towards developing either antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy into adulthood. There's a risk. It's a risk. It doesn't mean it has to be that way. With these kind of stories, whenever you read about crime and case studies and these things, you need to have sufficient detail to fully understand what underpins and what motivated their behavior, what drives their behavior, etc. And in this case, I mean, from a few things that you just said, you know, it was probably somebody who's been abused for many years and who kind of reactively, kind of in terms of almost, you know, defensively may have resorted into killing their relative. To me, that may not be necessarily psychopathic in general, right, in terms of these features. But it'd be difficult to say unless you see all of the kind of complexities of the case to make a full kind of diagnostic evaluation of that person. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess, yeah, maybe that's a good segue into the general question I have about, you know, it seems like in some cases we can make ourselves more psychopathic or fate in some way or a series of events can make us sort of more psychopathic. Like, for example, that the kid who shot his family, like even, you know, it seems like you could easily go down this path. You know, once you start doing horrible things, however it happens, it seems like you kind of, you know, one thing leads to another kind of thing. And you kind of have built a, without trying, you've stumbled down a psychopathic, kind of cascading pathway that where you have to live with the bad things you've done and you've become desensitized mm-hmm. and that becomes your new normal or whatever. Maybe that's a place to segue into the questions I have about, you know, some of these traits, like taking the psychopathic tests online, some of the questions to me seem like I could imagine if you got into a really cutthroat business, let's say like a, you know, a really competitive career, some of those paths seem to me to be more likely to instill traits that we would view as more psychopathic. So if you were like a, you know, a high powered lawyer, and you, I think you'd be more likely to answer some of those questions in ways that seem psychopathic, but it's just a way that they have to view the world in order to succeed. You know, like they have to focus on the results and not worry about people's feelings and these kinds of things. And I wonder if you see some of that, like that we can go down some of these pathways purposefully or not, that kind of instill in us by pursuing a goal or just by, you know, a random series of events that kind of instill in us more psychopathic traits.
Yeah, sure, of course. They, you know, what we experience over time manifests into who we are, how we perceive ourselves, our self-concept, how we interact with other people, etc. You know, if you've been hurt many, many times, you might try to toughen more up in relationships, for example, in order to avoid being hurt again. Right. Or if you've been exposed to severe trauma, for example, during childhood, that can have a huge impact on the way how your personality is being shaped. And how you, you know, view threats, for example, whether you become hyper or hyposensitive towards threats, for example. And there are different pathways, you know, there's not always one sure way of this is when X happens, this is how Y will look like. Even with trauma and some children, they might lead to, you know, highly internalizing behaviors in terms of high levels of anxiety and threat responsivity, etc. And in some children, we might see high externalizing behaviors. So they might actually become quite angry and aggressive because, you know, that's their defensive response towards the experiences they had. And in terms of coping with the trauma or dealing with those kind of situations, and that might manifest or long-term, if it's not addressed, into more problematic behaviors later in adulthood. So with many, you know, personality disorders and also other disorders, we see those adverse childhood experiences and that may have kind of led to unhealthy attachments, or that might lead to kind of unhealthy behaviors and maladaptive behaviors later on. And so even during adulthood, we might shape still somewhat. Right. So even though personality is relatively stable over time, it doesn't mean that it's not flexible enough to adapt and change. In fact, one of the things that makes our personality healthy is that we are able to adapt and change to our environments, and that we might, you know, change how extroverted we are, or how impulsive we are, or how much in sensation seeking we engage with. I mean, the older you get, the less sensation seeking usually happens, the less impulsivity happens. And that's an adaptive thing. And so in personality disorder, usually the main problem is here that we are looking at an inflexibility and a pervasiveness of traits that are compromised in terms of their psychosocial functioning. And if that flexibility isn't there for your personality to be able to, for you to behave in different ways and adapt to your environment, depending on where you are and what the requirements are, this is when things become problematic. And yes, I mean, you were talking about desensitization in terms of, problems when, as you develop. Clearly, we do see that in terms of attitudes and belief or schemas, belief systems people might have in relation to aggression, for example. If it is perfectly normal in the environment that you grew up in, that, you know, people are aggressive and in order to get what you want, you engage in aggressive behavior, then we might learn this and internalize this and use this as a strategy for ourselves later on in life. And this is where it comes back to, you know, having good role models, having good peer relationships, having healthy, nurturing environment in terms of and parental attachments, et cetera. All of these things that might have an impact on the way what we perceive as what is acceptable or normal behavior or strategies that we learn how we cope with the world.
Do you think, and it seems like there can be something of philosophy in there too, like people can actively kind of seek a more kind of selfish way of, you know, in an active way, you know, like say you're a high powered lawyer or you sure. Actually like, you yeah, you've actively told yourself, well, this is the way I have to be. And I will actively pursue this cold blooded, way of treating other people because that's what it will take. And you can even perceive that as a long-term good thing where you're like, I'm going to accomplish great things, but in the short term, I'm going to help the world, but in the short term, I'm going to have to treat people really coldly and do bad things to them. I think that's, you know, when it comes to some of these like high powered CEOs and these kind of people, sometimes I think there's this mentality of, you know, embracing kind of psychopathic or lack of empathy ways of treating other people because they can perceive themselves as doing such great things, you know, and it gets into the more like philosophy or, you know, motives of just how people can be.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, we have that construct of or concept of successful psychopathy, for example. So how in some individuals, these psychopathic traits might lead to adaptive outcomes or might be successful, right, in terms of how they navigate the world. And in some professions, you can see how being more ruthless and being able to walk over bodies basically is important to be successful. Right? So we do find more elevated traits in some of these professions you just mentioned, for example. So it is likely. However, on the other side, you know, if you're a manager working in HR and it's really important that you're able to lead a team well, etc., then sometimes that can backfire. You know, because if you need to have a team that can rely on each other and trust each other and hold each other's back, then, you know, you need to establish those bonds in a healthy way. And by being ruthless and deceitful or instrumental in some way, it doesn't necessarily always work so well. So it depends very much on the environmental context and what is required in that context. And in the end, one of the notions in terms of personality in general is that kind of we seek to be in situations or in terms of our vocational interests, we seek to be finding opportunities that suit our traits. right? So if we are more aggressive, trait aggressive, for example, then we might seek situations, opportunities, jobs, etc., that allow us to express that trait more easily, right? If we're not, then we will find places that are really calm and agreeable and friendly, right? If we don't like this kind of behavior, then we try to avoid those type of situations. So even in terms of which job you might end up with or seek or really want to do or are really good at might be underpinned by your kind of personality traits.
And maybe we can end with what are you working on these days?
Well, we still work on the notion of the dark empath to try and disentangle, delineate a little bit more around that notion. What happens if you have dark traits and high levels of empathy? How does that make things different for you? And I mean, we've only looked at that in the general population at the moment. I'm not clear. Would that be a possibility in criminal forensic populations? Maybe not. Maybe the hallmark of the lack of empathy or really low empathy is very much kind of exclusive in those criminal. Maybe that lack of empathy is that particular problem that leads them to be in that kind of criminal population. So right now we're just looking at the general population in terms of those dark traits and how various factors might be influenced or vary as a function of your empathic capacities. We're also interested in measuring things in more implicit ways. So one thing I want to, because often we use self-reports, right? And so in self-reports, you know, you might have some social desirability aspects in there that are problematic. You might have a narcissist, for example, would always say how great they are in terms of course, I'm great in understanding other people, right? It doesn't mean that they are in reality. So we are trying to test various kind of experimental paradigms, for example. We also been working a little bit around identifying some kind of biomarkers or physiological algorithms, etc., that might be underpinning various mental health aspects, for example, not just in terms of psychopathy, but as early kind of indicators that might help to alleviate risk in mental health, for example. But yeah, it's trying to disentangle that complexity a little bit more and not making it just such a simplistic thing, but trying to understand more the different mechanisms that might be involved and how they might lead to different outcomes as well. Because we can't just chuck everything into one pot.
Right. That's what I liked about your work, and what got me to reach out to you was your work in examining that nuance and the dimensionality there. Yeah. And thank you for coming on, and thank you for talking about these things, and thanks for your work.
Thank you, Zach. It's been great. Thank you very much for inviting me.
That was Nadja Heim, a psychology researcher who specializes in dark traits. If you're interested in her work, I'll put some links to some of her papers and writings on the page for this episode on my site, behavior-podcast.com. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast aimed at better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. If you've enjoyed this podcast and want to support it, consider signing up for a premium membership, which gets you ad-free episodes and some other benefits. Go to behavior-podcast.com to learn more about that. Or if you'd like to just send me a gift, send me a message via the contact form on my site, and I'll send you my PayPal and Venmo information. Okay, thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.